Welcome to another episode of the Sea Control Podcast, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. This week is another iteration of our Falklands War series with the Phoenix Think Tank and the indomitable Alex Clark, who we can now call a doctor because all the paperwork is done, but not a real one. It's mostly history, so you should probably avoid giving him any sort of medical equipment or scalpels or anything like that. Not because I'm worried about you, I'm more worried about him hurting himself. But what he is good at, aside from taking care of his decidedly un-English poodle, is this fantastic interview with Nick Vox, Major General, Royal Marines, retired, who is in 1982 the commanding officer of 42 Commando, a unit absolutely critical to Britain's victory during the Falklands War. He is the author of Take That Hill, as well as March into the South Atlantic. Alex runs a fantastic interview on leadership, personal perspectives, and operations during the Falklands War, and as I have said many times in the past, we are so pleased to be able to host this great series of first-person histories. So, sit back, relax, and we will be back to you with the Falklands series and Major General Nick Vox from 42 Commando, after this short break.
Do you like the Sea Control Podcast? Sure, we all do. However, we're only a small sea in the ocean of content available to you, our dear listener, at the SimSec website. Sign up for a membership at www.cimsec.org/about/membership. China may have a 9-dash line, but our seas are clear, and we welcome your opinions and articles. Please take a moment while downloading this podcast to leave us a 5-star rating and a comment. We need them. How do you think we pay this electric bill? Money?
One small note before I turn you over to Alex. You'll note, somewhere around the beginning of today's podcast, that there is some cell phone interference with the General's comments. I promise you that this interference is very rare during the podcast. I realize you're probably like me and will turn something off if you think the audio is going to be bad. That's absolutely not the case today. I want to leave that note out here to ensure that you don't miss any of this really good content. Thanks, and here's Alex Clark.
I have to say, before we begin, I've read your excellent book, and I loved it when I was doing my bachelor's dissertation because it was the book which I found the most personable.
Oh, well, that's very kind. Thank you. I always tell people the story that when I decided to write it, when I basically decided to give in to Max Hastings, who kept saying to me, "You must write a book," I said to him, "Well, how do you set about writing a book?" And he said, "Well, the most important thing is you have to identify who you are writing the book for, and once you've done that, you must stick rigidly to the sort of the image." And he added, "Whatever you do, don't write a book for your friends or your colleagues." So I decided in the end to write the book for the mother of Marine X, you know, in my commando or any other for that matter. And so that she would understand it. A couple of years later, I actually got a letter from a woman who wrote to me and said, "I want to thank you for telling me what my son would never have told me himself."
That is good. That is good.
Yeah.
So, I was just listening to that and thinking that through, and I was actually flicking through some of the pages while I was saying it and was thinking, yes, that is perfect. That is exactly it. The question I start off with is this. What was the position of the Royal Marines, do you feel, in the 1980s, before the Falklands War? What had they been doing? What were they looking at?
Well, I would say that the position, if you want in political terms or in strategic defence terms, the position of the Royal Marines was pretty precarious, and that was for a couple of reasons. One, we were all the amphibious shipping was basically falling apart. It was so old. and nobody wanted to spend any money on replacements, perceive a role, and as you know, personified by that ignorant, financial, incompetent John Knott, who decided that everything should be scrapped because there was no apparent amphibious role in the future. Not helped by the Royal Navy, who in those days still clung to the the myth, if you like, that there were going to be blue water operations against fleets of Russian submarines and, you know, all the things that the Navy had been configured towards for the previous two or three decades. And so I think those are the two reasons why, yeah, it was precarious. And we owe a lot to General Galtieri.
Yes, he did rather have a good sense of timing on these things. What specifically do you think about 4-2 Commando and yourself had prepared you for this sort of mission, for the Falklands?
Well, we were exceptionally fortunate because, as you know, the Royal Marines had this Arctic warfare role to reinforce the northern flank. And so the whole of the, you know, just taken over command when we deployed to Norway for 3 months, and we did nothing but train, and train in very adverse physical conditions. And so when we actually got back to UK and went on leave, you know, that unit was as well trained as it possibly could be, and all the sort of command team and associated organizations were at peak efficiency. And so we were very, you know, for us, we were very lucky. And to a lesser extent, that applied to the rest of the formation as well, because they, in one form or another, had been at readiness, you know, 3 months before, perhaps, or many of them had all done Arctic warfare training as well. I mean, there's no doubt about it, Norway, and operating there over the previous few winters was very significant.
And that was a very useful experience in the Falklands, which was, well, I read in your book, one of the gentlemen who was, one of the Royal Marines who was explaining to at Northwood described it as operating on the moon. And myself, I think, well, the moon might have been preferable. It would certainly have been slightly drier. Now, moving on from that, what was it like when the call came through that you were going to go south? You know, when it first started, did you think that 4-2 was going to be sent, or, you know, what was it like?
Well, the actual call came very quickly, and for us, in 4-2, it was pretty dramatic because, of course, two-thirds of the unit were all over the place on leave. But everybody came back very rapidly, and I can't remember the exact timescale now, but the mounting out was very swift indeed. So we were all sure we were going to war, until well after we'd sailed from the UK, because everything happened as quickly as it did. Once we got to Ascension Island and into that poise period while the politicians argued about whether this was going to be resolved or not, there were times when I think everybody wondered, are we actually going to do this, or are we just going to sit around here and you know, you get ready for something that isn't going to happen. But there was plenty to do while we were waiting, so morale didn't suffer at all. And then when we sailed from Ascension Island in the task force, as far as I'm concerned, everybody in the unit really believed we were going to war. You know, it was never really an issue.
what was it like going down? How did you maintain the men's readiness and preparedness? Because you had, well, if I remember correctly, 4-2 Commando were on Canberra, weren't they?
We were on Canberra. So, first of all, it was comfortable. And secondly, there was lots of space to train and to keep fit. And of course, for most of the time, the weather was good as well. So whereas I think troops in other smaller ships didn't have nearly such a kind of ideal time as we did, it was not a problem. I think if it had gone on much longer, it would have become a problem because, you know, you can only go on for so long saying, we have to do this and rehearse that and remind ourselves of something else. But in the actual time scale that occurred, it was fine. And perhaps a point of interest is that, of course, it wasn't just 4-2 in Canberra, it was 4-2 and 40 and 3 para. A recipe that most people believe would lead to all kinds of bloodletting and cap badge rivalry and so on. But in a curious kind of way, and I think it obviously depended on the leadership, we never had a problem. I mean, the paras, you know, realized that, like we did, that we were all going to fight together, so we might as well train together and get on with each other, and that's what happened. And it was very reassuring.
It must have been fun cramming 3,000 quite pumped up elite infantrymen onto a ship, even the size of Canberra. It must have been quite a tough management experience.
It worked, I think, because, you know, I don't want to use too many well-worn phrases, but I mean, they are elite units, and that means they had very good junior leadership, you know, corporals and sergeants and sergeant majors and those sort of people, and everybody, you know, just imbued the spirit of let's get ready to get on with it. I think if you contrast the morale of those three battalions on Canberra and how when they landed in the Falklands, and then compared it to everything I've heard about the two Guards battalions coming off the Queen Elizabeth, very, very different story. And that would be to do with leadership.
And, of course, with you, you, of course, in your leadership, Major Guy Sheridan wasn't with you on Canberra, was he? He'd been deployed.
Yeah, Guy had already gone off to South Georgia. And for me, that was quite a significant setback. But it was my decision to send him, which I've never regretted, because he turned out to be the pivotal figure in the whole business. Who, because he was an international mountaineer who'd been to South Georgia, loads of experience in Arctic warfare and everything else, which the SAS most definitely did not have. And so, although I really needed him, he was in the best place at that time.
And of course, for you, it meant you had to suddenly form, well, what was in effect a fourth rifle company.
Indeed.
Because you, of course, you had one company had gone down to South Georgia, and 4-2 was, well, for want of a better phrase, didn't want to be left out of the war because they only had two companies.
Exactly. Yeah, no, this is absolutely true. And it was very... like those stories of, you read, you know, of people saying, go out and recruit one or two friends and come back and bring them with you. That's really what happened, because once we were on the Canberra, we set sail, and the kind of significance of our situation became apparent. Mike Norman, who I'm sure you know who I'm talking about, who was on the Canberra having been captured at Government House and then sent back, and he was very, very keen to join Fortu and have a kind of combat role. And so I sort of said to him, well, if you can find enough people that we can really start thinking we can form a company. And he was back, you know, within 48 hours saying, I can't remember now, 200 guys are all signed up for it. Because at the end, as Canberra sailed, they crammed in all kinds of people who were reinforcements or backups or substitutes, and these are the people we used.
They did a very effective job. If I remember correctly, that was Company M, wasn't it?
No, it's called Juliet Company.
Juliet Company.
And in a rather nice twist of fate, the commando organization, or the organization of a commando, has changed in the last 20 years, and they now have four maneuver units, and so J Company is a permanent part of 4-2 Commando today, which I always think is rather fun.
It is rather nice. So, how involved did you feel in the planning process for the conflict as you were going south? You know, did you feel, were you consulted at all, do you feel, during the, well, to quote from your title of your excellent book, The March to the South Atlantic?
Well, it was very difficult, Alexander, for us to be consulted too closely, because once we'd sailed, before we sailed, Julian Thompson and his headquarters hardly had a mission, you know. I mean, it was all vague and simply get everybody out there and we'll sort out what we're going to do when we're a bit closer. When we were in Ascension Island, as a commanding officer, I think I was involved as much as I could have been. Like, I think I went to two major O groups where either there was initially a kind of outline plan and we were all invited to, you know, kind of have our say. And then, you know, the final orders group before we sailed. But to answer your question another way, I never felt frustrated that, you know, I wasn't more closely involved, because I could see that there was really no way that could be done. And also I didn't have the information that they did, you know, to, is that enough of an answer?
That is enough of an answer. It probably sounded like a horrible question, like I was fishing, but what I was trying to get a sense was how included you felt in the process. And from that, I think I've got the impression that you felt as included as you could be under the circumstances.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Moving on from that, well, you get to San Carlos Bay, and of course, 4-2 Commando were not part of the first wave.
We were a reserve unit.
Were you happy with that decision?
We were reserve unit, and I was not too unhappy about that. I mean, somebody had to be reserve, and in a sense, you know, you felt that, well, at least if we're a reserve unit, then there might be all kinds of opportunities that come along fairly quickly. But what was really disconcerting was to be on the Canberra early in the early morning and realize the terrifying threat that the Argentine air attacks were posing. I mean, I don't think anybody had quite recognised, you know, how dangerous the situation was going to be. And I was very, very nervous that Canberra was going to be hit, because she was the biggest target and packed with explosives and not terribly manoeuvrable.
And bright white as well.
Yes. And then we'd be trapped there, or worse, you know, we'd be sunk there. And so, being reserve unit for about 6 hours was a pretty nervy experience. Anyway, as you know, we got taken off, and other than having to leave behind quite a lot of equipment, which later was definitely going to make life a lot more bleak, we were ashore and ready to go by the end of the day.
And of course, much happier for that. Now,
yeah,
you had possibly one of the most interesting experiences in moving across the Falklands. You know, there was the helicopter movement that 4-2 Commando and took part in, and you led, has always seemed to me to be one of the pivotal movements of the land battle, the land campaign.
Yeah.
Would you like to describe that and, you know, go into some detail about how that came about?
Well, it really came about with an initiative from Michael Rose and his SAS planning, whatever you want to call it, element. And they were sort of engaged in lateral thinking, perhaps is the way to describe it, while the rest of the brigade headquarters were overwhelmed with sort of more mundane problems like, you know, logistics and exposure and goose green looming. And it was Rose who worked out that because they had an SAS patrol near Mount Kent, that possibly whatever, a coup de main was feasible. And when he asked me if I was up for it, and I looked at the map, and I thought, hang on a minute, we're talking about flying 30, 40 kilometres away from everyone else into this completely unknown, and then looking at taking a possibly well-defended major feature. It was quite daunting, but the thing was, okay, 4-2 had three rifle companies now, and we were just the same as anybody else, but I knew, and so did the others, that someone was going to stay behind to be the garrison. And I think in the end, what persuaded me to say, yeah, I'm up for it if the brigade headquarters were, you know, supported, was the recognition that if we weren't for that, we were committed to the, you know, the major battle. So that's what we did.
Get you into the war. And Mount Kent is a major thing in the Falkland Islands. Getting it, it can't be understated at that position. I'm just looking at the map in your book. I flicked through it quickly. It is very, very close to Stanley. It should have been far more resisted than it was.
Yes, well, we were very lucky, because you see, what happened was that it was well defended. I think the Argentines had a quite a strong company group up there, and they did have one or two support weapons and machine guns and things. But in the panic of Goose Green, that company was airlifted off and flown down to Goose Green, where, of course, it achieved nothing and got captured. And not that we knew that, but it made life infinitely easier, because, I mean, when Peter Barrington's K Company reached the summit of Mount Kent in the early hours of that morning, there were only about 20 Argentines there, and they very sensibly all ran away. But you're right about the other part, which is that it's one of the most significant features in the whole of the Falklands terrain, because it's so high that you have observation, you know, all over, right down into Stanley. And you've obviously read that we brought down a couple of long-range salvos into the outskirts of Stanley, because we could actually, you know, see what we were doing.
Very useful for damaging the morale of the enemy, that one.
Yes.
Also, it's notable for... Well, in your book, you have a foreword by Max Hastings, and of course, in the section, in the chapter on this movement, you describe Max Hastings and the different perspectives on how he managed to get himself along for the journey. It does seem to be one as if the modern generation of war correspondents would do similar tricks, and you know that has to be one of the greatest stories a journalist, especially of the size and shape. Physically of Max Hastings, managing to, in the kindest possible way, talk himself aboard a helicopter, which is heavily laden anyway, must have been...
Yes, it's true. Well, he was a immensely resourceful war correspondent. He was probably more respected by people like myself than many of the others, because of course he had a pretty amazing track record in wars all over the world previously. So, you know, you sense that he knew what he was talking about, and actually his dispatches, if that's the word to use, were going to realistically reflect what was happening, as opposed to maybe some of the others. Just to put it in context, he only got on the my command helicopter because he was with Michael Rose, and we had already allocated three or four, I can't remember, places to the SAS top team, you know, to fly in with us. And so if Michael Rose chose to bring him along, that was fine with me. I think it's worth tracking on to the end of the war and just remarking that probably one of the bravest things any of the war correspondents did was when Max Hastings decided to walk into Stanley before, you know, the task force, anybody else got there, because that could have been, you know, curtains for him. And I'm sure there were moments when that was quite possible, with all these frightened and not very disciplined Argentine recruits. But he perceived the opportunity and he took it. And in the same way, he perceived the opportunity for Mount Kent, because, you know, I mean, no other journalist was jumping up and down saying, "I want to fly into Mount Kent in the middle of the night against a heavily defended Argentine position that I remember."
And he did make him pull his weight by making him carry a missile.
Yes, indeed. Which he did, with no complaints whatsoever.
So you can you could call him war correspondent, you could also call him pack mule.
Yeah.
If he ever listens to this podcast, I'm so going to be getting a lawsuit. Ryan, so you've moved to Mount Kent, and that is, frankly, an astonishing feat in itself. And doing that alone would, I feel, have earned 4-2 Commander a long recognition in the whole of the South Atlantic campaign, along with, of course, South Georgia. But it doesn't stop there. You go on and take a very full account, a full part in the following battles. And, you know, how did you prepare your company for that? How did you feel they sort of responded to the task which came ahead after doing what must have been quite a for everyone involved, a sort of, if you go with the Bank of Courage theory, the going to Mount Kent must have used up quite a lot in that bank.
Well, it certainly did for K Company, because they had two attempts to fly in appalling weather, and that was probably one of the most frightening experiences in the war. The rest of the unit, of course, didn't really feature on Mount Kent other than K Company and TAC headquarters, but when we all were sort of flown forward and reassembled, if you like, reorganized, I think, if anything, the success of Mount Kent kind of increased commitment, if you like. And, you know, the guys thought, well, you know, if we could do that, we could certainly go forward and have another successful battle. The other point, which is probably useful, worth mentioning, is that J Company had been flown down to Goose Green as reinforcements, and although they never actually fired many shots in anger, they were very much involved in capturing the prisoners and disarming them and all the rest of it. And their message, when we all got back together, was that these guys were not a formidable enemy, and if you got stuck into them, the chances were that you would have a fairly easy victory, as it were. And so that kind of permeated through to the other rifle companies. So when we were into the serious planning stage of taking Mount Harriet, and people were beginning to look at the plan and think, you know, crikey, are we really going to do this? It was a great help, if you like, that the success on Mount Kent and the words back from Goose Green indicated that as long as you could get into them, the RGs would crack quickly.
And that proved sometimes to be the case. The thing which I found quite interesting in your book, in that many of the other books written by Royal Marines do seem to forget them in some respects, is the emotion you attach to the arrival of the BVs, of the quartermaster turning up with your company's six vehicles. In your case, it seems to be quite a large attachment to the hard space for you to sleep on and help your back. But how is it, the sort of, how important are they, do you feel, to a commando's abilities to operate?
Well, I wouldn't exaggerate their importance vis-a-vis, you know, any other support vehicle in different circumstances, but what did make a big difference at that time was that everybody was tired. I mentioned earlier that we lost our large packs, and so the guys were, you know, continually wet and cold, and Trenchfoot was beginning to make an appearance, and all these things were mitigated to a degree by the sight of these beasts slithering through the mud, bringing up, you know, some of the things that everybody really needed. And from a personal point of view, apart from having a place to rest the back, it gave me an incredibly enhanced command facility. I actually had all the radio sets and the radio operators in the BVs, you know, and this is what we've been doing in Norway. So very quickly, the commander headquarters started to operate in a much, much more efficient quick way as opposed to trying to do it crouching in the mud in a bivvy.
Does make life a little bit more... I would never say commanding anything in a war zone can be easy, but it makes it more doable.
Yes, exactly.
Yes. Now, the battle for Mount Harriet was Harriet. I don't know why I keep calling it Harriet. I've done that a couple of times recently, and it just seems to be terrible. It was a sort of, seems to me to have been a particularly well-fought battle. Well-fought operation. Would you, and you're probably, you're fine if you want to do the, what I find is the traditional Royal Marine thing of playing down it, but do you agree with that assessment?
Yes, it did work very efficiently. I mean, it was an elaborate, some would say, certainly original plan, and it definitely depended on, quite a lot of professionalism, notably moving at night without being detected, and but the interesting thing to me is that there was never, I mean, lots of people said, goodness me, how did you think of doing that, you know, why take such risks? The fact of the matter was there wasn't much alternative, because frontally, there was nowhere to go. There was a great minefield in between. And to go any other way would have almost certainly compromised what 4-5 Commando were having to do. And they had a difficult enough task taking two sisters. And I always had an obsession about blue on blue, because I'd seen it happen in other theatres, and you know, the one way not to shoot your own people is to be in control of what you're doing, and so that's why, you know, it made sense to do what we did,
and it worked.
It worked, yes.
Which is the important thing.
Which was very much the important thing.
And of course, that put you even closer in a way in the sort of the move to Stanley, and the battle that was never fought was of course the battle for Stanley itself, because the Argentinians surrendered. But the movement into Stanley must have been a very, well, tense time, because even then no one was quite sure that everyone would stick to their negotiations, were they?
Yes, it was definitely rather bizarre situation altogether, because as we advanced towards Stanley, yes, there were white flags waving around in the hills, and we were getting orders, you know, not to open fire on people, but you could tell that the Argies were basically completely disorganized, and once one actually got into Stanley, there were these masses of frightened, confused, in some cases resentful young men with, you know, guns and ammunition, and nobody really telling them what not to do, as it were. So it was a bit of a powder keg, and I think it was testimony to, you know, that well-worn British discipline that it actually worked, because if we'd, you know, if troops had started shooting people indiscriminately or using more aggression than was necessary, it could have all gone badly wrong, but it didn't.
I was lucky. Let's just for a second turn to what in your book you call the Forgotten Company, M Company on South Georgia. What was it like, sort of, for you as a commander, a unit that you'd built up, your unit which you trained in Norway, you'd gone through all this with them, to have, I know you did do an excellent job, and the Juliet Company certainly replaced it very well, but Was it at any point did you sort of think in your mind when you were planning, I wish I had the men of N Company here because this is something I would rely on them to do?
Oh yes, very much so. I mean, they were absolutely part of the unit, and it was, you know, a great rift really that they just disappeared. And other than very few snippets of information that, you know, like South Georgia's been recaptured, until Guy Sheridan reached us, I'd really no idea, you know, what they'd done and how they'd done it and what their role was thereafter. I mean, for quite a lot of the time, we rather hoped that, you know, they'd be sent back and a garrison would be established in South Georgia. So, yes, it was a gap. And of course, the other thing was that you worried about them because you didn't know what was happening and what they were doing. But I sensed that probably they were just sitting on South Georgia. Nobody was telling them what was happening. I knew that Chris Nunn's brother had been killed, and so obviously his morale would be, you know, really, really low. And altogether, until Guy Sheridan reached us, I think everybody worried about them more than missed them. I mean, yes, we missed them, but, you know, we were worried what was happening to them, what were they doing now, kind of thing. But certainly, if there had been a chance to have them back, it would have made a big difference, yes.
And finally, because I don't want to take up too much of your evening, what lessons would you like to take from your experience in the Vaughan's War and pass on for future generations here? What do you think are the absolute things that everyone should take away from what happened and what your experiences and what 4-2 Commando did during the war?
Well, I think at a parochial level, I'd say that if you know that you're going to war, then you absolutely must focus Marines, you know, the young's mind on the realities. So you read in the book that on the way down in the Canberra, we had some very, very realistic medical training and some fairly brutal lectures from doctors and so on about, you know, what it was going to be like to be shot or, you know, when your oppo was. And that is very, very important because otherwise the sheer shock of seeing people wounded and all the rest of it can be very traumatic. And in the same way, I think, again, at what I call unit level, you also have to say to people, listen, this is a lot different to training or counterinsurgency or any things you've done. You are expected to kill people ruthlessly if necessary, and you have to leave your wounded behind, and all the things that go against the ethos. The aim is to, you know, take the feature or whatever it is. I'd always say to people, you until you actually see the power of artillery or air support or even mortars and machine guns, until you actually see it operating for real, you don't understand how important it is. I mean, to me, the most effective weapon I had in the Falklands was artillery. Once I realized how accurate they could be, how devastating they could be, how flexible they were, I clearly underestimated the effect of what they could do. And so training, you know, with all arms training and support operations is vital, really.
Thank you very much. That was brilliant.